Hello and welcome to another edition of the Fox Football Podcast, a special edition this one, a topic with a bit of a difference. Don't think we've ever done a podcast along these lines before. There might be a reason for that. We'll know in about an hour's time, perhaps. I'm Adam Peacock. Great to have your company. And I've got the company today of two men who know how to run a football club, or at least we think they do. We'll be the judge of that soon. But no, they do know exactly how things run in Australian football in particular. Tony Pignata, the CEO of Perth Glory Football Club. How are you?
Very well. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. We've hooked this into a trip to Sydney, basically, because we don't get to travel much anymore. So you've come to us. Thank you for that. And Danny Townsend, who had to battle through Sydney traffic to get here from Sydney FC, their CEO. Danny, how are you?
Good, mate. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Thanks for coming in, guys. And this is not a podcast where I'm just going to bang on about current issues and, you know, why is this happening and why is that happening and give my opinion. I just basically want to know, how do you run a football club? Now, I don't know if the time frame we've got is going to cover everything off, so we're going to try our best. But the first thing I kind of want to get across, and because the A-League is a league with a bit of a difference, and we will touch on the W-League as well, but the A-League has a salary cap. Now, that's unusual for a football club around the world, but you guys have you know that going in to your respective roles. And Tony, you've been around the traps with Wellington, also Sydney FC before Perth Glory. Exactly how much of a hindrance or how much of your existence is based around managing a salary cap and managing a roster with the football department?
A lot. Mm. Yeah, a lot of, I love my spreadsheets and, you have a spreadsheet and I know I speak to probably Burnsy and Popper every day about it, who what we've got left, what we can do, especially now the window's open, you've got injury replacements, you've got homegrown. There's a multitude of different facets of a salary cap and you've got to manage it and make sure that it's accurate and, everything that needs to go in there goes in there and what you've got left is what you can spend.
What are the intricacies about managing a salary cap and basically is it like a household budget? Like I've got this much to spend, so this is how we're going to do it and manage it.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. You know, at the end of the day, for us as well, it's about planning for the future, not necessarily the season you're in now, but the future seasons, because we're looking to take advantage of as many of those concessions you get through loyalty and homegrown to ensure that you're able to get the most out of your in-the-cap players. So it's not necessarily just about what I do in this window or what we did in the pre-season, but really what we're doing over the next 2 years, because, players are now wanting longer contracts, which is great, provides you with a bit more stability. The player gets more stability, but equally the club can start to get more consistency in its roster. And I think some of the CBA changes to the cap last year were really designed to try and get clubs to behave in the right way. And I think it's done that.
With your conversations that you have with your football department, your head of coach, and you mentioned Jacob Burns there. He's your
football director.
Your football director,
Paul Reid.
Yep. At the moment, it was Terry McFlynn.
It was Tezza, yep.
Before Tony Pignata poached him for Perth Glory over there, bit of a lifestyle change for Tezza. But I get to the point of the interaction and the daily interaction. You mentioned Tony about your football department and your head office. So you guys basically act as the negotiators. You're guided by your football department. How much reining in do you have to do with the football department? How's that balancing act for you guys?
Look, I think it comes down to relationships and trust, right? So, those guys know what they're doing and the results on the field demonstrate that they've got a track record in getting it right. I think, our roles, and Tony, you speak for yourself, but for me, I'll typically handle the negotiation when it gets to a point where Steve will say, I want player X. We'll get into a negotiation with an agent. We'll work out the best deal we can do for the club and ultimately manage that within the confines of the salary cap or out of it if it's a designated player. So, our job, I think, is to facilitate the best players for our coach. And once he decides what he wants, it's probably our job to go out and get them.
So Steve understands that he doesn't want to really do the face-to-face negotiating when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of a contract, but he'll talk to the player to sell the football side of things.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, that's a critical side of it, because nowadays players are looking for that comfort that they're going to put themselves in an environment that they're going to be successful, and I can't give them those guarantees. It's talking to the coach and the other staff and the other players, frankly. Our players do a lot of talking to incoming players to talk about the culture of the club, the facilities, the way we look after them, the environment we put them in. So that type of dialogue is a real key part of recruitment.
Is Popper the same? Works the same way?
Yeah, he does. So, if Popper wants a player, he'll talk to his staff as well. Generally, we get given players as well, or Burnsy, we'll have players, so we'll mention that. What about this? What about that? But he'll be the same like Steve, call the player, sell the club, and then we'll do the negotiations. We'll see what we've got left. And we work with Jacob, we work sort of very similar. If he's got the contact with the agent and so forth, then he'll deal with that. And all I can provide is the numbers, basically, and what we can can't afford, and we go from there. And ultimately, it's about trying to get the player to the club.
So you're the ultimate yes man or no man,
on a financial point of view. Yeah, what we can and can't afford, and then for sometimes the football department, as you were saying, Danny, it's about ensuring next year, etc. But football department wants a player now. Don't worry about next year. Back end it. Yeah.
Oh. Does that go on? Back end of contracts?
Yeah,
absolutely.
It does. Yeah.
Has to.
Yeah.
It does. So, for example, now you're working in a window which you don't have much cap. So you only can play a certain player so much. So you've got to try and top it up the year after or the year after. Our salary cap spreadsheet, well, the one I run, which I used to run at Sydney FC as well, is a 3 or 4 year moving, sort of evolving. And, salary cap is very intricate, because you've not only got loyalty or homegrown. So a homegrown player is someone who's come through your academy. Mm. They've changed the rules now.
What's a homegrown? So you get a discount, do you?
Yeah, he doesn't go in the cap.
Doesn't go in the cap.
You could effectively, in 3 or 4 years' time, have $1 million homegrown player playing for you that's come through your,
You're paying $1 million but doesn't go inside the cap.
Exactly. Okay. Used to be $200,000 maximum. Now it's open-ended. Mm. And then you got loyalty. So loyalty starts at 4 years, 12.5%, right through to 10 years, where you get 50%.
Yeah, Ryan Grant. Half his wages are exempt from the cap.
Yeah.
So define academy, though. How long does the kid have to spend at the academy?
Well, as long as it's his first professional contract with you. Yeah.
And we've tightened that up in the last CBA as well to try and reduce the, let's call it, poaching that goes on, that clubs might sit back and maybe not invest as much in an academy and then just sit back and wait to see a kid who's starting to stand out and then offer them a professional contract.
Like someone like a name that pops out for me here is Cameron Devlin, who came through the NPL system in Sydney, was at Wanderers for a little bit, mm-hmm. was at Sydney for a little bit, and then ended up making his A-League debut for Sydney, but now doing good things at Wellington. So where does his homegrown status lie?
It doesn't.
Okay.
He's not homegrown. Like, we had Jake Brimmer. Jake came from Liverpool.
Yep.
So his first professional contract was at Perth. So until the rule changed, he was a homegrown. So his salary wasn't in the cap. Next year, it's going to be in the cap.
Why's that?
Because they've changed the rules that the player's got to have a academy line or NPL line or something.
Has to have played in your youth system at some point.
Yep.
Sounds like you're dealing with the ATO here. They change the rules all the time.
Well, I mean, if you speak to John DeLuizza from the PFA, we won't be worrying about this in the next few years.
Well, yeah, that's my next question. What does that do to a football club? And we can talk about the commercial realities of not having a salary cap and what it might do to the league and send it in a certain direction. But in realistic terms, in the short term, what would not having a salary cap do to contract negotiations, to building a squad?
Look, it depends what club. I suspect for different clubs are going to have different sort of boundaries that they work within. You know, we work within a budget. And ultimately, the cap sits as part of that budget, and then you have your designated players or marquee players outside that budget. And ultimately, my job is to ensure we put the best team on the paddock and don't exceed that budget. Now, with exemptions and allowances through things like homegrown and loyalty, we're able to spend a significant amount more than the cap within the guidelines of the rules. So, therefore, I'll spend less money on marquee players.
Yep.
Because ultimately, I'm trying to get the most out of the in-the-cap players, and then I'd sprinkle a couple of marquee players on top within the budget, and away we go.
How many marquees are we allowed?
Two.
Two marquees can be from anywhere.
Correct.
And you've got Castro.
And Fornaroli.
And Fornaroli. You've got...
We've got Costa and Lafondra.
And Lafondra.
At the moment. Yeah.
Fair enough. Mm.
But you also, if you don't spend the cap 1 year, you can bank it the next year.
What?
Yeah. It's called banking.
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 So if you, if you're under the cap, you can then use a portion of that cap for your next season until you run out.
It's like our Kyoto credits with
very much so.
Climate change.
So there's a whole, down the road. There's a whole heap of different things that you've got to be mindful and relocations that doesn't
agent
go in
fees.
The cap. Agent's fee goes in the cap.
What
FBT goes in the cap.
Fringe benefit tax.
Yeah, yep. So if you give a player a car, a portion of that car and its value, his fringe benefits tax goes into the salary cap.
Mm.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's mind blowing. Who sets all these? By the way, like, do you get a say in what?
The CBA negotiation between
the Professional Footballers Association, the union.
Yeah, the union
and the FFA.
And the FFA, which we're a party to those negotiations, as in this in the consultation process, but we're not a party to the contract. But then that then passes on to the regulations that are then sent out to clubs to abide by.
Fair enough. Will it change once the A-League gets shifted from the FFA to the clubs themselves? Are
yes.
you going to be running your own rules here? Or
yes.
Yeah?
Really?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the challenges...
it's a news to you.
Yeah, look, it's an evolving process.
The clubs can't run the rules.
No, the league's go will.
Which is like the FFA, effectively.
Yeah,
Greg O'Rourke and his team will run...
Correct. Yeah. Correct, imagine, but it won't be the FFA. But what
imagine
we're
the
saying,
clubs running the rules.
That's not a bad idea. But with that, there's a current CBA that's about to be renegotiated. So that started already. It started last week. And that's designed to be in place for the rest of this current TV deal.
It's the drunks running the brewery, that is.
Happy days. Let's get after it.
How is fans always want to have a go at the FFA when things that they're not happy with, bang, oh, stupid bloody FFA, why are they running it this way? Your dealings with the head body, is it a frustrating process or is it everyone's on good terms and they're trying to go in the same direction? How do you find it?
I think operationally it's good. It's really good. And it's interesting, when I came into my role, I believe what you read from the outside, you get in and think it's going to be a fractious situation. And I think my experience 2.5 years in is quite the opposite. You know, I think the work that we do day to day with the executive and operational staff of the FFA has been fantastic. So I don't see any issues with it.
No, look, it's great. There are frustrations. Mm. Like, I tried to get the game moved last week, 4:30 kickoff in 35 degrees. Mm. You know, we originally had it at 6:45. I get it that they had to move it for broadcast, et cetera, but that's still frustrating.
Sorry.
Well, it's not you guys. It was actually ABC.
It was the ABC 5 o'clock game, the game off the back of it.
So there are, but, you know, professionally you get on with it, decisions made, but the relationship's very, very good with the A-League and their team, and we work very closely because ultimately it's about making sure the game goes forward.
Just before we get on to other topics, back to contracts, because like, basically your playing stocks are, you have a good team, it's an easier sell for you guys in terms of commercial revenue and just basic engagement. Danny, I don't mind if we can touch on a specific here, like the Brandon O'Neill situation.
Mm-hmm.
So his contract is running up. He's made it abundantly clear that he wants to go one day and play overseas somewhere. How do you balance that? Is it a football decision or is it partly your decision? Yes, we've got a valuation for this guy. Okay, we're not going to be a better team if he leaves at this point of the season, but we've got to take the money to help with the revenue stream of our football club. How do you weigh all that up? Because it must be a real hard decision.
Yeah, look, for starters, I don't think, you know, our club's not really a selling club. Like, we don't sit back and start building budgets based on selling players. But equally, the realities of our league are that these players that are playing well are, one, going to attract interest, but two, have ambition to go abroad. And Brandon was an interesting one in that he got to the end of his season last year. We won the championship, I think his second championship, and he'd achieved a lot. He won the Player of the Year. And naturally, he got to a point in his life with his new wife, I've got to make a decision around my future. Do I want to stay in the A-League? And it was clear to us and to him that he wanted to test himself abroad. But at that stage, he didn't have anyone. He didn't have a club. And you can, that's the hard part. You can never actually define a moment where there's going to be a club there for you. So we sat down with him and said, look, we understand your ambition. we want to keep Brandon O'Leary for as many months as we can. Mm. And if whatever happens in January or June, if a club comes in and pays a fair amount of money, that's not unreasonable, we're not going to hold him to ransom, a fair amount of money, we'll let you go. And that's what happened. And, you know, equally, it's about reciprocating what other players put into the club. Like, Brandon was a fantastic player on the field, but he was a fantastic asset to us off the field. He was a very good human being. He was exactly the type of person that our club have culturally. Mm. So to stand in his way at that age would have been the wrong thing to do as well. So you've got to weigh up all those.
Have you got a set valuation then in players' contracts, like buyout clauses?
It's becoming more and more prevalent. Yeah. It's a bit of a bugbear of mine, frankly, and it's where sometimes when we sit down on CBA conversations, and JD and I have had conversations around this to say, well, the PFA's view is we're leaving a lot of transfer money on the table by doing short-term contracts. Mm. On the flip side, the agent's behaviour is very much driven around, well, I don't want you to unfairly put a price tag on my player that will sort of mitigate his chances of...
Like the Keanu Becker situation at... I know you guys can't talk about specifics of another club, but I'm just reading that Wanderers have said $1 million. Mm. And too bad. If they don't meet that valuation, you ain't going anywhere.
Yeah, and look, there's sometimes, and you would have done it, I've done it, you got to dig your heels in and say no.
Like Josh Belante last season.
Yeah, Josh, that was a similar situation. We had it with Adrian Merzieski and these sort of things where the player is adamant they want to go, and the reciprocal fee that's being paid doesn't match the quality of that player. Mm. We've got to stand up for our club. We've got to stand up for our supporters who want to see that player playing at our club, or they want to be properly compensated. And if they're not willing to pay it, then they're not respecting us or our league.
Has Pohang paid, by the way?
No, mate, no.
How have they got to pay the bill?
No, they'll pay.
They'll pay.
Because we won't release his ITC until they pay.
Oh, international transfer clearance?
Correct.
Ah, good idea. And he can't play until they pay.
I remember my time at Sydney FC, Ninko came in. Mm. Wanted a transfer, big money, I think, in Middle East. And we said, you're not going.
That was Qatar, wasn't
it?
Or something? Yeah.
You're not going. That. And he, you know, sort of, you know, kicked up a bit of a stink. And I said, look, you know, when you came here, you wanted a three-year deal. Mm. We gave you a three-year deal. You're in your second year. You're not going. Mm. And you know, the board backed that decision. And look at him now.
Thank you for that, Tony.
No problems. Help you out.
he's had some issues in the last couple of months.
Yeah,
Milos Stinkovic. But just a hard negotiation.
When I do contracts, I don't do buyout clauses in contracts because you know ultimately, if you put a value a player at 300, you know, and it triggers, then you've got to let him go. There's no negotiation for you.
Yeah.
So you know, we had Jason Davidson, no buyout clause. He came to us. He had a really good opportunity to go to Ulsan. We sat down. We didn't want him to go, but we understand for his family and the revenue that and the income he can earn, he's got to go. And sometimes you work that through and you get a figure that is satisfactory to both parties and you move on. But then you've got that negotiation. If you have a buyer clause, say, you know, 150, 200, and they trigger it, you've got no negotiation. You've got to let them go.
How, in the Jason Davidson case then, as an example, how do you negotiate with another club about a transfer fee?
Well, they'll come in and always lowball.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think I'm getting sick and tired of A-League just, you know, from, you know, sort of A-League clubs getting lowballed by other clubs. Now, you set a figure and say, look, this is what we value Jason at. Mm. If you don't match it, he's not coming. And it goes back and forth until you say, right, that's the figure. And then they go, okay.
It's like buying a house.
Exactly. Mm. Yep.
Same thing. Yep. Yeah. Where does that money go then when it comes into the club? You then distribute it how you see fit, or you just lump it in the bank and then – because you can't go out and buy players. Even though Adelaide, with Riley McGree this season, became the first club in the A-League to pay
a
transfer fee.
Melbourne Victory was the first one with Hernandez.
Mm. Carlos Hernandez.
Yeah, bought him out.
Okay.
Yeah. It just goes to your bottom line. It helps reduce the loss.
At this spot stage. On. One day you're going to make money.
Yeah.
One day.
Correct.
Perhaps.
Yep.
It's fascinating because then you've got agents thrown into the mix as well who are trying to drive the revenue for their player.
Yeah.
So you're trying to drive the revenue for your club, and you're dealing with a club that's trying to drive the revenue. Anyone that thinks that football's not based on money, sorry, that's unfortunate. But
whenever they say it's not about the money, it's always about the money.
It's always about the money.
Yeah.
How? So you've got no, not even on your young players, you've got no
buyout clauses. No
buyout clauses. No.
Look, it forms a lot of part of the negotiation because all agents want buyout clauses for their players.
Yep.
But we won't stand in the, anyone's way if it allows them to further their career, income, etc. As long as we get a fair deal out of it, then we move on.
Do you have to play psychologist with your coach when the commercial reality is that we're going to sell this player, and then you have to go to the coach and say, sorry, mate, I didn't want to let him go, but, you know, this is what it's given the club.
Yeah, I think even you have a very transparent relationship with your coach, they're well aware of it. It's never going to be a surprise. And I think with the Brandon case is a good example. I think, you know, Steve understood Brandon's situation. He understood where he was at in his career because he was there when we worked through his renegotiation 9 months ago. But importantly, he also looks at his current squad and goes, well, I've got Paolo Retra and Luke Bratton who've been playing the last 6 weeks together anyway and haven't lost a game. So he feels probably more confident in the guys he's got to cover, obviously the gap that Brandon leaves behind. So that may have been different if maybe Paolo and Bratton weren't playing well together and we'd maybe lost a couple of games. I'm sure Steve's view on the Brandon transfer would have been probably different.
Because it's hard with our squad to replace players. I mean, last year we lost Lowry, Davidson and Spira.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole backline gone. Mm. And, you know, it's hard work to get them back, you know, to that level, playing again. But, you know, Pop is aware. I mean, as soon as we get an offer in or what, he knows what's happening and he'll have a chat to the player as well.
How much does it help you guys that you've got coaches who know how the A-League works? Like they get here and they don't have a series of what moments, as in, what? That's how it works? What?
Very important.
Yeah,
because you get foreign coaches who'll come here, think it's a Europe where you can go out and buy or sell players, there's no salary cap, et cetera. They don't know the players. I mean, most of it, you know, you only allow five foreigners, so the rest have got to be Australian players. So I think it's very, very important to have Aussie coaches.
When we went through the recruitment process to hire Steve and replace Graham Arnold, that was a real key criteria for us, was understanding whether that coach had a knowledge of, one, a salary cap, but most importantly, Australian players, because to Tony's point, that's going to form the vast majority of your squad.
Yeah. Fan engagement. How difficult, easy is that? How do you find it? How much of a role in the day-to-day operation of a football club is involved in that?
It's everything. You know, if you look at all of our revenue streams, at the centre of all those revenue streams is the fan, aside from transfers. Mm. You think about, you know, our ticketing, our hospitality, our merchandise sales, you name it, our media money. You know, the fans engaging in watching the broadcasts of our sport is what drives our value proposition and our ability to operate. So engaging and growing the fan base is a number one priority of a football club.
Yeah, and I mean, I use Twitter a bit. Calm the masses down sometimes. Control the message.
It's impossible to control sometimes, Tony.
When I think it was round four, we were last, and the fans that loved us last year, you know, sort of jumped off, and you just try and keep everyone calm and tick along. And they, you know, and I know you do it as well, Danny, they appreciate that you take time to respond to their messages and so forth. And, you know, we're out and about as well, and, you know, members are a lifeline of the club. You know, everyone's trying to grow the memberships and get people to the games, have enjoyable experience and get them coming back. And it's very, very important that we do that and keep them happy, make it, you know, sort of a great experience when they do come to a game.
Is the game a hard sell at the moment? Not just saying to fans as well, but for all your, in terms of trying to grow that revenue stream, is it a hard sell? We sit here right now.
It is. Why is it? I think, look, there's a lot of interest in the game. There's no doubt a lot of interest. And you see through our metrics in social media activity and people watching. Our fans have a different, way of viewing a game. You know, now you can actually watch a mini game on Fox before you sort of have to watch the whole game or take snippets. I think at the moment with summer, at the moment in Perth, you know, you're on Cottesloe Beach at 4 o'clock. You're not going to leave the beach to go to a A-League game at 4:30. But they will follow it from the beach, whether it's on their phone or through the Telstra app or through, you know, Foxtel Go, etc. So getting people to the ground is very, very hard. Our memberships are up and doing well. Sponsorships up, hospitality's up.
Why is that? Because you were successful last season?
Yeah, I think a big factor is success. And you would have found that, you know, look at Sydney the last few years in terms of their success. And that keeps people going. Because in the past at Perth, we'd have one great year and then a few down and people, you know, jump off. And I remember last year, I think it was like, you know, round 11 or 12, we're on top, but people say, oh, it's not going to continue. They're going to fall over. They're going to fall over. So it's success is a big part, and that's spending money in the football side as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's to Tony's point, I think there is a huge amount of interest. You know, people have been saying it to death. You know, we have the biggest participation numbers in the country of any code. They're engaged in the game. And we're only sort of a generation old. That's our biggest challenge, is there's not multi-generations of fans that their father and their grandfather went to Sydney FC games because we didn't exist. So we've got to battle that. But I think equally we do have a really unique fan experience. You know, when you come to a Sydney FC game and the Cove are in full flight and everyone's in sky blue, and I know when I bring friends who may not be football people to a Sydney FC game for the first time, they're like, wow, this is amazing. The noise these guys make, the atmosphere that is created is very different to a Roosters game or a Waratahs game. So, you know, I think we've got a lot going for us in that respect. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for playing in those smaller stadium. We're benefiting from that at the moment. And I think it's proving that, you know, our fans, when we first talked about being displaced from the SFS, it was all, oh no, it's going to be a disaster. And I think they've actually gone along to these stadiums and gone, wow, this is actually good fun.
Yeah, you've gone all right at Cogra as well. You haven't lost a damn game there.
That helps.
Yeah, look, my frustration is I remember when we played the grand final 2017, Sydney FC versus Melbourne Victory, it was 43,000 people there, 40,000 in sky blue. Last year we played Sydney FC at Optus, 57,000, probably 55 in purple. Where are they gone?
Yeah.
They come for that game and we sold out 57,000 in 4 days. It was amazing last year. The whole town got behind Perth Glory, the media, the government, everyone, and to sell out, you know, A-League grand final record. Then we come back to round one, we had 9,000. So the
fans, I think
that
goes back to what you said around, yeah, they're following it. They just may not be coming to the game. And that's our challenge, is how do we bridge the gap from sitting on Cottesloe Beach to getting them to come to the venue? And that comes down.
And I know ticket prices are high and people are saying, well, okay, well, you're charging $35 for an adult to come to a game. You know, if I add that and buy drinks and car park, and it does add. It is expensive. You know, but it's also expensive to go to movies or go to restaurants or go to a bar and have a drink. So, you know, our stadium deal is expensive, so we have to try and recover some of those losses. And we, honestly, we lose probably $50,000, $60,000 every game at HBF Park,
So is that the stadium deal that you've locked in with? Who owns HBF Park?
Venues West.
Government?
Venues West.
The government?
Yeah. But, you know, the Allianz Stadium, great deal, you know. And you think, you know, Sydney versus Perth, but the Allianz Stadium, I know when in my time there, we'd make money every game.
I don't understand how government – I don't know how the government can make money from a sporting event. I know you guys are a business. I just don't understand the concept of a government that taxes us anyway. you pay your taxes and then eventually a sporting team ends up in debt to the government for playing a home game, for playing their sporting game.
Last year they introduced transport cost, so per person. So at Sydney FC it was just a weighted average, but at HBF Park or the government charged us per person would come. Whether they took a train or bus or not, we got charged a couple of bucks. So you'd have 10,000 people there, it's 20 grand a game multiplied by that 14, you know. And sometimes like $25,000, $30,000.
I know Brisbane have had the same issue.
Yeah.
But they have to get 11.
You know, the Gold Coast, there's a lot of merit in – not really, not merit, but anything over 5,000 triggers transport cost.
Yeah.
So are you going back to Clive, are you, mate? Come on.
But you know what I'm saying?
Clive's a genius.
Oh, but I had a numerous meetings with the transport minister. Anyway, they've reduced the cost, but it's still you're still paying $10,000 to $15,000 per game.
That's what I understand. Like, what's 20 grand to a government? Seriously.
Well, I suppose they see themselves as their own department, their own P&L, their own business unit.
We're fortunate in our situation with a stadium like Allianz prior to its redevelopment. They got members, right? So they have other revenue streams. So some of these stadiums, the only way they can make money or at least break even is by charging fees for venue use. the business model for the trust is slightly different, which helps us because we actually bring them content which they need to provide for their members.
Yeah.
So we are providing a service, but equally we still pay a fee. And, you know, I think to Tony's point, it works well for us, and, you know, it's why it's been our home since day one of the club. So
yeah, the only issue we have is in Perth is that there's no it's only us and Western Force, and Western Force don't play many games.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're probably paying the price of not having a lot of content.
Another tenant, unless you get a good pitch, though.
Yes, we do.
Back to you, Danny. Allianz.
That's a can of worms there.
So it's an ongoing discussion, obviously, yep. Because the government, if you're not across it in New South Wales, the government have spent all this money to say, yep, we're going to have this brand new stadium. And before it, it seemed that, yeah, we're going to put down a big curtain at the top, and it's going to lock off the stadium to make it a 30,000 intimate, well, relatively intimate setting, which is rolled gold for Sydney FC. Because if you get 15,000 there and that noise is bouncing around, and that sounds like 20, 25, 30. If you get 30,000, wow. But now that they've started to build it and there's delays and all these things going on, as always happens with governments, they're saying that maybe the curtain's not going to be there. So it's going to be this big 50,000-seater stadium like Suncorp every week, and that's going to sound a little bit different. Can you comment?
Yeah, look, I think I've commented a bit on this recently, sometimes out of context, mind you. Look, we bought into a two-mode stadium. That's what got us excited because, you know, to your point, and what we talked about earlier, fan experience is critical. If you create a great environment for fans, they'll keep coming back. So, you know, it's no secret that we average about 15,000 fans. So week in, week out, operating in a club mode, which was the 28,000 lower bowl, made sense. And when we had derbies and final series matches and grand finals, we open it up and we get 43,000. Fantastic. Our corporate facilities would be world class. It was a no-brainer for us. I suppose what's challenging is that with the, I suppose, all these things, the costs go up. And one of the challenges for the government has been able to afford to put in the curtain. And look, we've been clear that we want the curtain, right? But equally, we're happy to work with the government and with the SCG Trust to find a solution. It doesn't need to be a billion-dollar digital curtain. Mm. It just needs to be a function that enables us to close off the top layer. And look, the dialogue with the government and with the trust is that we all want it. We've all just got to find a way over the next 2.5 years to
just some blankets or something.
I said the old red velvet curtain from the cinema. Get that out. But
exactly.
You know, you go to a Sydney Kings game and they shut the top tier of Qdos Bank Arena and you feel like you don't even know there's a seats up there sometimes. And that's just a black curtain. Admittedly, it's an indoor arena, so it's a little bit different. We've got wind and weather to deal with. But look, we're confident by the time we get around to opening it, there'll be a solution and that's what we've got to work with the government and the trust on getting.
Does the government get, and back to your point there, does the government get football, or is it kind of blinded by how big and how commercially viable NRL and AFL seem?
I think they get it. They get it, you know, when the grand final comes to town, and they get it when Man U comes to town or Chelsea, because they're, you know, all the, I suppose, economics of, you know, hotel, restaurants, and that's why they bring out these big teams. So they get it. Do they get a week in, week out and help out Perth Glory or Sydney FC? Probably not.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Mm. Interesting. Revenue streams for a football club. So broadcast is one thing, and that's locked in for the next 3 years.
Thank God for that.
What happens? it's turned out to be a pretty good deal.
It's fantastic. 16 years, is it?
David Gallant cops it. But so you get that grant, you get a guaranteed grant which covers your basic salary cap from broadcast.
Correct,
yeah. Where do you see the big jump in a football club's revenue in Australia going forward? If you put the broadcast to one side and say, okay, we'll try and roll that over for the next broadcast deal, where else can you go, righto, this is where we're going to grow and this is where we're going to flourish?
We've got to diversify our businesses because football clubs in Australia don't make money. I think all 11 or 10 last year lost money. It's not sustainable. We've got to get to a point where our game is sustainable. And part of the separation from the FFA was build enterprise value in these organisations and some freedom to trade in areas that they were restricted. We were restricted in the past. So things like creating commercial propositions outside of what we have today are things that now we can do, knowing we have control over our IP and the league itself. So we've got to start looking at other things in the media landscape, in other areas of community football, to try and deliver I suppose, a compelling proposition to the marketplace that will pay for it. And that's going to need to be things other than sponsorship, merchandise, the traditional revenue streams of football clubs. And that's where we look ahead at Sydney FC and go, well, you know, in 3-odd years' time, what does that media landscape look like? Who knows? We all know it's changing pretty rapidly. So we've got to mitigate for potential downside. Mm. We're not going to get that through the traditional revenue streams we've got.
I mean, they help. But, I mean, look, what Western United are about to do and build their own stadium, I mean, there's probably some merit in that because they'll control the whole stadium. They control the catering. Mm. So we don't control catering. We don't get a cent. Oh, we get like a 1% or 2% of the revenue. They can have concerts there. They can have conferences, signage, everything. They control the whole stadium. So there's other revenues there that they can get. Yes, they've got to build it and pay it off, but I think that model is something that a lot of clubs around the world are doing and trying to diversify their income and with things outside sport as well.
Yeah, but how easy is that to do though?
It's very hard. I mean, try to find land in Sydney.
I'm trying to find it for a centre of excellence and that's hard enough. Yeah. Yeah, look, I think that it's challenging. And the other thing is that, look, there's a reason why in Australia virtually every major stadium is owned by the government or the council, because making money in the stadium business is very, very hard. So, you know, I think it's different to, say, the UK where those little stadiums have been built 120 years ago and they just get upgraded every decade or so, or in the US where there's lots of space and they go and pick a patch of land and go, let's go build a 20,000-seat MLS stadium. Mm. So, and they've equally got economies that will support that with population, right? Yeah. So we're talking about population size of 25-odd million. You've got 300 countries with 300 million people. We've got cities that have more than 25 million people in them that are able to sustain lots of stadia. We just don't have that luxury, and that's why we've got to try and work within the confines of what we've got. But look, if you're in an environment like Western United, if we were in that part of Australia, you'd absolutely be mad if you didn't look to build your own facility.
Is transfers a revenue stream that needs to be tapped in a bit better with A-League clubs, or is it?
Well, I'd love to see that we can, you know, transfer players within the A-League. Mm.
But not just transfers in the A-League. Say you develop a kid and go, yeah, cool, sell. We can sell a player every year and that'll...
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky enough. We sold, I think, Danny De Silva before my time. Jacob Italiano went to Mönchengladbach. Mm. You know, if there's ones or twos you can do and bring them up through the academy and, you know, the big club can get them and, yeah, that really drives the revenue as well.
And it's a unique thing for our code in this country, right? The NRL can't sell players. You know, NRL clubs can't sell players. So it is an asset for us that we should be monetising, and it's a focus of ours to start to really monetise the investment we make in our academies. You know, most clubs, I think, now have well-established academies and they're expensive. You know, we spend over $1.5 million a year in youth development. Right? It's a lot of money when typically one or maybe two, if you're lucky, of those kids each year are going to graduate into our A-League squad. So you've got a lot of other kids who are very good footballers who you've invested a lot of money in over the course of their 6-odd years in your academy. You want to take them on a journey in professional football outside of Sydney FC. Mm. So how do we do that, and how do we build a network of clubs that enable us to go and take, say, that third best player in the under-20s and send him on a professional path somewhere else and monetise it?
And monetise it, yeah, that's the key. Give us an example of something that has made you guys go, what? That rule exists, or that exists inside my job remit. Kind of makes you think, well, I didn't know, and trying to pass on something here to a general fan that might not know how an A-League club operates that is involved in the process of running an A-League football club. Tony, you've been around the traps for a bit. You've seen a fair bit.
VAR? No. Do we bring that to
No. That's banned on this podcast. That's the Monday one. Not this one. Banned.
I can't think of any sort of rules that we go, what? I mean, we're pretty much, I suppose, okay with most rules. I mean, generally the rules that come down from FIFA through their football competitions. Mm. And we follow it. I know we've tried to do some stuff with referees, mic them up, etc. Mm. I mean, Jared Gillette's last game, he was mic'd up. It was fantastic. Mm. That short 10 minutes or whatever it was brilliant to watch.
Thanks.
Yes, well done. It was good. It was very interesting. And some of the conversations that we've seen around...
Yeah.
Yeah, that word.
Dot.
Yeah. Explaining the decision. I think the going back on VAR, the biggest frustration for fans and players and everyone, they don't know what's going on.
Correct. Mm. 100%.
Don't know. Even if you're home, you don't know. Yep. So they need to look at that and have that conversation, go, look, I think you need to check this for a possible handball or we think it's offside, hold on. Yeah. So fans are aware.
Yeah. And to be fair to the FFA, they want that and they're lobbying hard with IFAB to get, you know, to be a bit of a leader in that space. So I think if we can get to that, it will go a long way to dispelling some of the frustration, I think.
Yeah. Well, Sydney get all the decisions anyway, don't they?
Yeah. Well, that costs us though.
Yeah.
Expensive. It's expensive. But, you know, I think as a CEO, and this is something that you'd be familiar with, Tony, but one thing that sort of, I suppose for me, opened my eyes when I took this job compared to working just general businesses. I had an agency for a long time. But the stakeholder management process is very, very challenging. You know, you probably underestimate how many different stakeholders you've got to manage as a CEO of a football club. You've got your players, you've got coaches, you've got your admin staff.
I know.
Owner, board, media, members, fans, local associations, FFA, PFA, you name it. There are so many different stakeholders that you need to be mindful of when you make decisions because one decision is going to have an impact, positively or negatively, on someone in that stakeholder group. And you've got to be ready for dealing with the negative, but equally, you know, obviously helping out.
Well, your next home game, you'll probably cop it from a fan for selling Brennan O'Neill. Not cop it, but someone will come up and go, what'd you do that for?
Yeah. And look, I've got personal emails from members going, what are we doing? Mm. And you know, I will go back to that member. I'll call that member and explain. I can't put that stuff in the public domain, but I'll go one-on-one back to that member and say, look, we sort of know what we're doing. Just trust us, right? We're not stupid. There are circumstances behind decisions that you are not going to be aware of in the public domain, but you've got to trust that we know what we're doing and we're going to make decisions in the interest of winning trophies for our football club and putting a sustainable business model forward to keep our club alive.
I mean, Tony Danny going that good that his club's bringing people back from the dead, his fans, like that poor guy who had the heart attack the other day.
That was probably one of the most scary moments I've had in my life.
And he's all good now?
Yeah, he's fantastic. You know, those medics, when you look at that situation, and the two medics, who not the paramedics who came with the ambulance, the medics that were on site, the two girls worked for 15 minutes in that heat, and I was just watching them going, wow, they were amazing professionals.
Yeah, that was the fan who had the heart attack and still with us, and we'll be at the next Sydney FC home game, sorry.
Just to go to that point, I remember when Nicky Carr went to Bunyas. Copped an absolute tirade from a lot of fans through emails, tweets, you know, what are you doing? He's our best player, et cetera. You know, he just copped it. 3 days later, we announced Alessandro Del Piero. So there is, you know, they got to sort of trust us. And I get it. You know, when you sell a player, you know, like when Andy Keogh left or when Davidson left, there are reasons why you do that. And you can't explain publicly why. But ultimately, you know, we try to do the best for our club and manage everything as possible.
There's differing reasons, isn't there? Yeah. The Keogh situation was different to Lowry, it was different to Spiro, it was different to Jason Davidson. So.
Yeah. I mean, we'd love to have Spiro back. Absolutely.
It just looks like he doesn't want to be a footballer at the moment, which is fair enough.
I think he's enjoying life in Melbourne.
He was at the Portsea Polo the other day.
Yeah, exactly. In his shorts. And
well, you can tell when a guy's enjoying life, he's not wearing socks and long pants. So, it's kind of relaxed atmosphere that Spiro's involved with now.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Half his luck.
I got to ask you, like a thing like a marquee, like you in your time, you've gone off after some big ticket items, like your big friendlies that you're having, and you've got them at Perth at the moment as well. You've probably got another one lined up. I don't know if you can say anything, but going after Zlatan, you got Del Piero, so you don't mind going down the path of, hey, let's try something here.
Yeah, look, I mean, Alessandro, I still can't believe that happened, to be honest, because it was, you know, just an email out and let's test the waters. With Zlatan was fair income. I mean, people think, oh, just, you know, sort of doing it. But no, we actually touched base with his agent who appreciated. He did say he's got a lot of offers on the table. We didn't discuss any financial. We just wanted to know if he was interested in coming and play, you know, 9-10 games in the A-League. And it does work. Is it a short-term fix? Probably, but we need something to, you know, to sort of start the league and get fans coming. You know, I'm sure if Sutton played against Sydney FC, we would have sold out Optus, no doubt. And that's only good for football.
Just back to the Del Piero thing, that started with an email?
Yeah, just an email to his brother saying, look, what about the you know, coming to the A-League. And I remember Lou ringing me and saying...
Lou Sticker, the agent.
Yeah, Lou Sticker. What do you think? I said, just send him his brother an email. Lou had already been in contact with him 6 months earlier.
Yep.
At that stage, Alessandro had, you know, offers everywhere. But anyway, as they were dwindling and he hadn't had a contract in, I think it was end of August, yeah, and they touched base 2 days later saying, let's have a chat. That's how it starts.
Mm. And commercially that worked? You paid him a lot of money. Didn't make the team better.
No.
At all.
No.
Gave us some great moments.
Yeah, exactly.
Like in terms of highlights.
Yeah, look, it was fantastic. I'll still say this, and I know Danny's the current CEO. Sydney FC are where they are now because of Alessandro. And ooh, I'll say that.
Because Graham Arnold listening to this just fell off his chair.
No, they are because from a commercial point of view.
Okay, yep.
Because when Alessandro came, we had no major sponsor at the club.
Mm.
We had posted a $7.2 million loss. I had got Webjet within a few weeks of me starting before they knew Alessandro was coming on board.
Yep.
Out of that, we got, you know, Destination New South Wales, we got members, and he drove hospitality, fans, everything like that. Then Graham Arnold came, and from a football point of view, that changed, became successful on the park as well. But we had those fans and sponsors for 2 or 3 years beforehand. So they stayed with the club, and then the journey continued. Steve came on board. They're a juggernaut. You know, beat us in the grand final last year. They're the measuring stick of the A-League now, yeah. Sydney FC. And they are. And, you know, credit to them.
Danny, sounds like you've got to buy him a coffee.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt. Like, a player of Del Piero's calibre playing in the A-League was probably unthinkable, you know, at the time. And look, whether he's made the club, I'd probably disagree, but I think he was a real important part of that next stage of the club's development, and yeah, probably put us on the map commercially and as a brand. But I think equally, you know, there's a lot of other people involved in the club that, like guys like Alex Brosk, who over the years have built on that to create heroes within themselves, like genuine heroes. Like Alessandro comes in and goes. What really makes heroes are people that stay the journey, and I think, you know, Broski's done that. You know, Dinko now is going to build that type of legacy when he finishes his time with us. People like Steve Corriger, who've been there for 15 years, like he's been at the club as a player, as a youth team coach, as a head coach.
Mm.
We've got board members like the Crismal family, like the Barlows, Tratkovenko. They've been there since the beginning, and I think those type of people are what really make your club, because you've got that continuity that allows you to build over the long term and make strategic decisions that may not pay back now. And that's what Del Piero was. He wasn't I don't think, and obviously wasn't there, Tony, but I don't think he did put a P&L together that said he was going to pay back then, that
no.
year.
Yeah.
It was about what that would do for us over the course of the next 5-10 years.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where you're coming
from, Tony. Yeah, maybe sort of a bit excited, but I think he came at the time and was a good base. And then, as Danny says, you know, it sort of, you know, took off from that. You know, Broski came back, you know, Graham came and really changed the whole football department, whole football philosophy. You know, got board members like Hamburger come on. You know, Scott and David took over the running of the club. So there's a lot of factors, but Alessandro was a sort of a catalyst. It came at the right point in time. And then people took that and moved it on to where they are now.
See if another one comes along, maybe at Perth Glory next season. Or
it's just getting harder.
It is harder. You just financially.
Oh,
yeah.
Financially.
Yeah.
We had the Torres situation, which, you know, we got very close to getting him over the line.
He was looking at schools in Sydney for his
kids. Wife was looking for gymnastics classes for his daughter.
Right.
So we were very, very close. And in the end, it was not about the money.
Yeah.
And
until it
was about the money.
About the money.
And when the other clubs that we were competing with, there was three, one in Japan, one in the MLS, as soon as they got wind that he'd made his decision and he was coming to Sydney, $2 million came out of nowhere and dropped into his inbox. And he went, well, hang on, it's hard to ignore another $2 million on top. I think I'll go to Seigen Tosu in Japan. And that's the challenge now.
He didn't do well there, did he?
No. And I think in hindsight, he probably regretted it because he would have come to Sydney. He would have been in a great environment. His family would have been living in Sydney and had 2 years to finish his career. And unfortunately, he went to Seigen Tosu, had one disappointing year in the J-League and retired.
Mm. Anyway. Yeah. That's the way it goes.
Yeah. I'm sure he's not totally disappointed, though, in his career.
I mean, we've got other players that have sort of, you know, Diamante at West United is a fantastic player.
He's great.
Great character as well.
He's a clown. He's great.
He's unreal.
Not a clown. I shouldn't call him a clown. No. It's just the way he acts. He makes me laugh. Mm. He's fantastic. So, yeah, players of that calibre, they're out there. It's just a matter of being able to get them and making sure everything kind of fits. Guys, you're busy, I know, because your phone has been ringing every when we're doing this. I don't think the phone's ever rung with guests like this before. Which
it's just my wife.
Oh, okay, sure.
Fifth time.
Yeah, sure. call her back, will you?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, good idea. But thanks so much, guys, for giving us a bit of an instructive look at how an A-League club runs, some of the challenges you face, some of the stuff that we didn't know. I've learned a bit over the course, and hopefully some of our listeners have as well. But Tony and Danny, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck to your respective teams this weekend and the next. Oh, you've got the weekend off, don't you?
Yeah,
so,
fantastic. No stress.
As we sit here right now, I've just dated this podcast. I think it's going out next week, so you've got a weekend coming.
The victory Friday night.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks so much, guys. And good luck for the rest of the season.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks,
Adam.
The brand new Professor and Barney podcast. It's really popular.
Big response in New Zealand from the first one, I assume?
Huge response. It was actually a record listening. It was a record for listening.
Wow. Each week, a new episode, and every episode, a new topic inspired by a current sporting affair. The latest, cheating, thanks to the Houston Astros.
I guess today's all about cheating.
We're going to look at the best and worst cheaters that have ever sort of graced the sporting landscape.
Great, and we're going the quirky and the weird. So if you've tuned in to hear about Lance Armstrong or Marion Jones, it's not going to happen. We've dug deep. It's going to be some weird shit.
Lawsuits not required.
Yeah, I wanted to talk for a second about the psychology of cheating.
Barney, I think it's important.
Mate, you and I have just been on a two-day trip away together. My missus doesn't need you talking through the psychology of cheating first.
Well, I wanted to ask you, Barney, what were you doing when I walked in that room? My God.
This is more of an intervention podcast.
Please search for the Professor and Barney podcast and hit subscribe wherever you do your listening.